everyone. Welcome to Project Herpetoculture Podcast. I'm your host, Roy Arthur Blodgett, and I'm joined as always by my intrepid co-host, Philip Leitz of Arids Only. We have an excellent show for you today, but before diving in, we have some brief housekeeping. So first, I'd like to thank Dylan and the Animals at Home Network for hosting our show. It continues to be a pleasure to be part of this platform. We'd also like to extend special gratitude to Charlie, who generously edits our audio and has done a lot to improve the quality of our show over time. And we'd also like to take a moment to tell you about our sponsors. So first, we have Custom Reptile Habitats, who have been with us since day one. They produce top-of-the-line PVC reptile enclosures, and I use them for a lot of the large format vivaria here. They're also carrying universal rocks, misking products, and a bunch of other useful stuff. So if you're in the market for any of that and you're planning to make a purchase, consider doing so through the link in our bio or description. We'll receive a small commission at no additional cost to you, and that really helps us keep the lights on over here.
Up next, we have Fairy Tale Dragons. That's a joint venture between Heather Moy and Ron St. Pierre, both of whom have achieved legendary status in herpetoculture. They've accomplished quite a lot and produce some of the finest bearded dragons and Taliqua in the country, alongside a whole host of other species such as emerald tree boas and green tree pythons. Check them out if you're in the market for any of that, and be sure to follow along with them on social media. They're always up to something interesting over there.
Next, we have Cold-Blooded Caffeine, roasters of delicious coffees from all over the globe. We have a private label with them, the PH Blend, which is a light roast coffee from Rwanda. It's a great choice for those who prefer a more floral coffee with notes of berry, but they have a wide variety of options for a broad array of preferences. So check them out. And if you place an order, don't forget to use the code PROJECTHERP for 10% off.
We're also very pleased to have the support of Exoterra, a brand that needs no introduction. It's safe to say that herpetoculture wouldn't be where it is today without the influence of Exoterra. For decades, they've been industry leaders in innovation, offering just about everything needed for reptile care, from diets and supplements to enclosures, substrates, and lighting. We're both big fans of their naturalistic terraria and substrates in particular. They have a lot of interesting products in the works as we speak, and we're really looking forward to seeing what comes next.
And next we have Tamura Designs. For those in the know, Tamura Designs is widely regarded as one of the finest enclosure manufacturers on the planet. They produce outstanding large format vivaria with endless options for customization, drains, UV printed backgrounds, lighting rigs. On top of all of that, they also make amazing deli cup displays for expos and these incredible multi-unit condos, which I use here. So if you're interested in any of that and you decide to make a purchase, use the code Herpetoculture for 15% off one item as a special offer to our listeners only. We also have Happy Dragons. We're really thankful to have the support of Happy Dragons. They are producing some amazing content for bettering our reptile care. And we've been actually partnering with them to produce even more content like webinars. Also, the platform and subscription service offers breeder access to first clutches, things like that. We have online courses coming down the pipeline. In addition, we have live Q&As with reptile experts, such as Mariah Healy from Reptophiles. It's truly an outstanding subscription package that also offers discounts on their supply partners, such as Ovapost and Joss's Frogs. It's really an outstanding product. So check it out. And let us know what you think.
And last but not least, if you're interested in supporting the show directly with something of a tip or a monthly donation, check out our Patreon page at patreon.com/projectherpetoculture. We have a monthly live chat there with all of our paid subscribers. That's been a whole lot of fun so far. We also have a whole line of merchandise like t-shirts, mugs, pint glasses, and more on our website. And of course, sharing the show with a friend, subscribing on YouTube, and keeping up with social media is always very helpful.
And with all that said, we're on to the show. Thanks, everybody. All right, everybody. This is Project Herpetoculture Podcast, episode 79. And we have an amazing guest today, Mr. Craig Trumbauer. Craig, how are you today?
I'm good.
I'm really grateful that you made the time to join us here tonight. And I think that, you know, just to begin, I'd love to hear a little bit about just your herpetocultural origin story, if you will. How did you get the bug and how did it go from there?
All right. Well, that's a good question. And I like to answer that question because I've done a number of things in my life. I taught school for a period of time. Unfortunately, I couldn't make a living doing that. But by the way, we owe a lot to our teachers. So, and yeah. They could use some raises as well. So, when I was a kid, I lived on Little Rock Air Force Base. My dad was a very famous World War II P-51 pilot. And we were stationed in Little Rock, and I went down to the creek with my BB gun after school, and I shot a ribbon snake. Mm. And I was bragging about it in school. I thought it was pretty cool because that's what you did. You shot snakes. And my teacher overheard that and called me up front. And she said, "Why did you kill the snake?" And I said, "Well, because it's a snake." And she said, "Well, I want you to go to the library. You're going to do a book report on snakes." And I think it's Schmidt's little handbook. I've got, I think, 15 of them. I buy them every time I find them, you know, and that was the book. And it had these colored plates in it. And I was mesmerized by that. I will never forget that. And I did the report. And the next day, I was so excited to get back down to the creek without my BB gun. And I actually caught another ribbon snake. And this time I came back home. My dad didn't care for snakes and he was flying. And my mother said, "Well, we'll have to keep it in an old tackle box for a while." Mm-hmm. And that launched everything at 10. In one of my books, I write a little chapter. It's called Yola and the Farm. And my dad was killed shortly after that, when I was 10. He made it 147 missions, World War II. Distinguished Flying Cross twice, Air Medal 13 times, and by happenstance, we were on a boat together with the family. My grandfather was driving the boat. My dad fell off the front, the prop hit him, and came up in the wake, and I dove off the boat, and the last thing I saw was him reaching for my hand and went under, so very traumatic. And in 1959, there was no counseling or therapy. It is what it is. And there was a big military funeral and flyover, and that was it. And it was over. And I was sent out that summer to live in Missouri on my grandfather's farm. And I got there, and I had grandfather gave me a 22, and I kind of went hunting. And every day I shot everything I saw. I just, an angry kid with nowhere to go with all those feelings. And I shot a mockingbird and blew its wing off and brought it to my grandmother, who's just a wonderful woman. Actually had a master's in nursing in 59, which was something, and sat in the front porch and asked if the bird was going to live. And she said, "No, I don't think so." She goes, "Why are you killing all these animals?" And that was it. I can remember the smell of her cotton dress, and I cried for an hour. And it was, the really, really about my dad and all of that. So it was a release. So the second part of launching my interest is, instead of killing stuff, I started catching snakes on that farm. Mm-hmm. And my grandmother actually encouraged it. We kept them in all kinds of containers. And quite a story about going out in the chicken house in the middle of the night, and taking a couple lactating mother cats with us to catch mice when we lift the corn bins, and we'd catch mice and feed the snakes. And came home that summer, and there, before FedEx and UPS, there was Railway Express. Mm-hmm. And they would ship anything. And my grandfather, with a good sense of humor, made a 6-foot screened in box and put all the snakes together. And sure enough, ding dong, and here's two guys holding a 6-foot screened in box full of snakes. And and my mom said, "What's this?" And we started, we'd drive around the neighborhood and we would look for old TV sets. Back then you had picture tubes in a TV, and when the picture tubes went, you threw the TV out. But Zenith and Motorola and all those TVs, if you took the picture tube out, you had a glass front, you had a square box, and it made a perfect cage. So pretty soon, I had a small bedroom with
with TV sets stacked on each other to the top of the ceiling, full of snakes, and never turned back. So, you know, at a time there was very little literature, Dead Mars, and you know, ancient people had read all of that, and really just kind of hung out. And then when I was 12, my mom would go to the commissary, because she could still go to the base, would go down to Miami go on the base, because she dropped me off at the Serpentarium, and I got, Bill Hoskin took me under his wing, and I was there, wow, you know, every week, and he's flirting with my mom. She was still, you know, pretty young. He's kind of a flirt. You know, I mean, you know, my big wish is, oh my gosh, he's gonna divorce, marry my mom, I'm gonna live in the Serpentarium. that didn't happen. But he was a great influence on my life. He's a great man, and taught me a lot. And as a kid, and I'll say briefly here, and I'll shut up for a minute. But you know, mentoring kids is a huge thing. Mm-hmm. And one of the things in herpetoculture I see, I don't go to many shows. I go one or two a year. I used to do quite a few of those, but we need a little bit more of that. You know, those kids that come by the table and you have, you know, 10,000 baby corn snakes and they can't afford one, you know, give them a couple. Launch an interest, teach them something. And, you know, becoming a mentor, and I've done it with several, you know, kids that have grown up, is, golly, it's about second to having children. It's a great thing. So, you know, I would hope, you know, that anybody listening would step up and do that. Take the time. Now, we're all busy, but take the time with that kid. And especially that kid that maybe didn't have a father around.
Mm. Yeah, well said. Mentorship is so important. I often talk about that too. Just, you know, it's one of the things that propels the whole discipline forward too, because if we're not passing on what we're learning, then somebody else just has to learn it all over again from scratch, you know, and that I think in a way can also impede the progress of the whole operation, you know, in addition to the, you know, the, obviously the human aspect of just, it can really make a difference in someone's life to show up in that way and, you know, encourage that kind of interest, especially in a young person. Yeah.
Let me give you a real quick example, and it sounds redundant to me because I've done quite a few podcasts, but you know, there's new audiences, and I think it's important. So let me give you an example of that. Mm-hmm. So three or four years ago, we were in Daytona at the National Reptiles Breeder Expo that, you know, I've done it for 34 years since the start, but we were in there at our table, and this guy walks in the door way in the back, and I said, wow, let's look at this guy. And he was like 6'10", and you know, those kind of people you notice, and you know, and I said, wow, I had a duck to get in the door, and we're sitting there, and he's walking, and I said, wow, he's coming over this way, and he walked right up to my table, straight to my table, and I looked at him, and he goes, yeah, I know, I don't play basketball, and I'm really tall. And I said, well, that kind of covers that. I said, I'm sorry. I'm sure you get a lot of that. I go, just surprised you walked up to my table. And he said, well, I was in Orlando. I saw the show was here. And I saw that you were still coming to the show. And I drove over here to tell you something. And he said, you don't remember me, but years ago, I was here with my mom. And you had a pair of Ocotee corn snakes babies, and my mom couldn't afford them, and I wanted them, and you gave them to me. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to let you know that I just got my PhD in herpetology. Wow. And I was over at UCF for some meetings, and I have to fly out, and I came over here to say thank you, gave me a hug, turned around, and walked out.
Wow.
True story. So you never know, you know. So you know, with all the troubles we have with laws and attitudes and things, we can soften the approach a little bit, I think, by mentoring and sticking that good hand out, doing a little bit of good stuff in the community, And I think that goes a long way. You know, you can give talks in schools and Green Wing Day, you know, fish and game things, and actually work with your agencies and make some friendships instead of all the hostility. And it works pretty well. It works pretty well. So,
I totally agree. It's and also it's like, I can imagine that for you hearing that, you know, from that man, as he came up to you, was just as rewarding as, you know, hatching this or that species for the first time, if not more. Yeah.
More so.
Yeah.
He walked out, I reached around and I started flipping deli cups like Frisbees to kids when they walked by. You know, it's like, here, I hope you get to grow up to be 6'10".
Yeah.
You know, here, maybe I can launch another one, you know? So,
yeah. That's awesome.
And look, a lot of young guys and herpetoculturists, you know, have maybe got into all of this for the wrong reasons. I always tell people, don't quit your day job to become rich overnight. And, you know, I know a handful of people that have, but it's unusual. And, you know, it puts a lot of stress on you to do that. Do it for all the right reasons. And be generous, you know, with your animals, and things will work out. So.
Absolutely. Yeah. I hear you on that and I agree. Welcome, Phil. Phil's back, everybody.
Sorry about
that's
that.
That's the other one, right?
Yeah. That's the other one.
I saw him for a minute. I think you just cut him off, right?
I think so.
The real good looking guy cuts his partner off, right?
Every time.
No respect.
Every time, dude. Every time.
No respect. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I'm going to let Phil have a question then.
Oh geez.
No, that's okay, Phil. I can keep going if you want. Okay. If you want to get oriented first, I'm just teasing you. Please.
Yeah, I'd like to be oriented.
Well, Craig, I mean, clearly you have a gift for storytelling. I know that that's one of your favorite pastimes. I've read some of your books, and I know that you're well known among your friends and peers for enjoying to share stories. So I'm curious about that and how that kind of transformed from, you know, just the decision to write a book
Yeah, you know, I mean, I never planned to write a book. I was writing some stuff down for my family because I thought it was worth somebody in the family having those notes, all the adventures, the places I've been, the things I've done, the late nights, a lot of things that you guys have done, you know, collecting and reading, people I've met. And I was writing stuff down and... Bob Ashley of Eco Publishing and the museum and everything, everybody kind of knows the Ashleys, and was in town. And at the time, we were living in West Texas, rebuilt a 100-year-old adobe and living out in the middle of nowhere after retirement, enjoying that. And Bob had called, and John Cann, the famous Australian turtle guy, a national treasure of Australia, one of the great herpetologists who I want to say just turned 90, was his guest and asked if he could come out. And we had a little guest house and I said, sure. And we had a great time. Tell Hicks, I don't know if you know Tell, the great artist, reptile artist. And,
yeah.
Tell was with him and his wonderful wife. And, you know, we just had a really good time, and he saw something on my desk and he said, you know, what are you writing? And I said, just some stuff for the family. And he read it and he said, I want to publish this. And, I was shocked. I said, really, you know, I finished the book. He published it. It did well. It's sold out actually. I think he's hoping I'll die before he has to do a second printing. But I'm going to push you on the second printing, and the second book has done well. So, you know, it's look that there's nothing special about those books. Those stories were written to encourage everybody to tell their stories, tell them to their family, because Everyone has unique stories that are just as interesting as those stories. And sometimes we just don't get them out there and tell them. And I think it's it's been such an important part of my life. I think it's important to get those out there, you know, and the response was surprising. It was really good. So, and of course, and I am a talker. I told you earlier that I think Will Rogers said, never miss a good opportunity to shut up. And it's the mantra I try to live by, and I fail miserably. So, you know, luckily I don't have a single malt Irish whiskey in my hand, because I would be telling you redundant, repetitive stories all night long. But,
how can we change this? How can we get an Irish malt whiskey in your hand right now? Let's make that happen.
we'll do that next time. I have some really good, fine single malt, and, I don't abuse it, but I have a great belief in some of the luxuries of life, which may involve a little bit of that. I had two parts of my life. I pretty rough, tough part the first half. I was the self-proclaimed quintessential tough guy, and went through the drug thing and everything else. It indirectly caused my brother's life, but. Luckily I met my wife 40 years ago, and cliche-ish made me a better man, and I am. But as I told my cardiologist and oncologist, I'm not giving up my cocktail every night, so you can just forget that one. And luckily they haven't asked. When they don't ask, by the way, and like I said, I worked a little bit in medicine, so when they don't ask, that means they're drinking something better than you are. And they're not going to bring the subject open, because, that's just the truth. So,
I love it.
Yeah.
I love it. Yep. That sounds there's a ring of truth in that for sure.
I have a question, Craig, something sure. I'm curious about. I'm 37. That's how old I am. And when I was younger, my interest in reptiles was something that I got picked on for, people kind of bullied me for it. People gave me a hard time about it. And that's, again, most of that was when I was real young, between the ages of like 10 and 16, 18 or so.
A common denominator, by the way.
Yeah, that's
you see. Yes.
Yeah. So that's what I was going to ask about, is like, because that, Even as an adult now, when people find out what I do with the reptiles, they are like, what? I mean, sometimes people are cool, and much of the time you get mostly curiosity more than anything. But I was sort of curious to ask about, sort of your experience growing up being interested in something that presumably in the 50s and 60s was even less common, I would imagine, right? So I'm curious what
it was, and people just look at you and say you're crazy and dismiss it. Nobody wanted to have anything to do with that. Luckily I had a mom that was pretty open to things, but very difficult cracking any doors. I mean, you never saw a pet store with a reptile in it, and it's just something that you didn't open. It's a very interesting question, because observing today and evolving from 50s and 60s, a lot of herpetoculturists experienced that kind of a bullying, discrimination kind of a thing in some ways, and a lot of them take different paths in life. It's really what I like about people. I'm a great believer to be your own self. I mean, I had a braid down to my waist before anybody had long hair. And you want to talk about something strange. Nobody had long hair. I had a braid down my back, and I had snakes. Obviously to everybody else, I will spare you all the terminology, but it was called everything in the world that was crazy. And actually, I was probably more normal than most people. So the appearance thing is interesting today, because you go to a show, and it's a show in itself.
And a lot of people struggle for their own identity. And I think in that struggle, they include reptiles in their life, something to take care of and give something back to them. And I see nothing wrong in that. I thank goodness through my dad's death and everything else that I buried myself in snakes and things. And later in life, I mean, I played football and sports and it was pretty popular. I really never got bullied or anything, but the snakes never left me. I mean, that just, you know, that was, you know, that, that was just part of it. But, you know, you see that today. I don't put labels on people just, you know, because they're different. Grew up in a time, you know, in prejudice, as, you know, especially in the South, I mean, colored bathrooms and, you know, black and white. Luckily, I was raised on Air Force bases and we integrated way before, you know, society outside the base did. And so I was never, and had great parents and never saw that, but I saw it all around me. And unfortunately, it's raised its ugly head again. It's still alive today. I don't tolerate that very well. If you ask my friends, I think we're all the same, and it doesn't matter if you have purple hair, and it doesn't matter if you're tatted up. I mean, you might want to lose the swastika underneath your eyes. Maybe that one, you know, but you know what I'm saying? There's room for that. And the reptile component plugs in, and for some reason, I think just because it's reactionary. I think a lot of people react to reptiles, react to snakes. Mm. And look, if I'm a girl and I've been bullied my whole life and I dye my hair purple and I have a room full of reptiles, you know, it's different. And in some ways it works for people, and that's okay. That's okay. We certainly should have moved past a lot of this by now, but we haven't. So,
yeah,
you know, well said. In some ways. Yeah.
Really well said. I couldn't agree more on all of that. It's good to hear that kind of appreciation for diversity in herpetoculture as well. Go ahead, Phil. I cut you off.
Oh, no, it's okay. So another thing I'm curious about is, you know, we talk a lot about how sort of common knowledge, the ways in which, you know, sort of like the drug industry has been intertwined with herpetoculture going back pretty far. Yeah, but it sounds like I'm guessing that your foray into herpetoculture might have led you to be surprised by that fact as it became a little bit more of a developed like hobby and practice for you. Do you have any like recollection of when you maybe had your first encounter of like, oh wow, holy crap, the herpetoculture, you know, I had no idea there was all this illegal activity involved in reptiles on this other end of things, because that was similar. I had an experience, you know, getting into it where I just thought it was a normal thing, you know, because I grew up with books and reptile specific pet shops and whatnot. So it was super common, you know, and I remember the first time I learned of smuggling and illegal, you know, having animals you're not supposed to have, and like the way that sort of the drug industry had been intertwined with herpetoculture in ways. And I'm just sort of curious if there was any kind of shock for you with that, or if it didn't surprise you, or what.
Yeah, you know, I don't think I was shocked. I mean, there really just wasn't that there really early on. Mm-hmm. You had a couple of the big reptile houses, Chase and Curtis, and, you know, later Louis, a good friend of mine, Porus and stuff, the shed and things. Mm-hmm. There really wasn't that at the beginning. It really was about the animals and lots of animals coming in. I mean, you'd walk into Chase, you had elephants and hippos and golly, wow. I mean, what a place, you know, and everything coming in. You know, laws were so wide open that it was rare to even use the term smuggling, because you just went and got it and brought it back, you know. But of course, as we evolved, all those things did change. For me, some people will know who this is, and I'll leave the name out. I lived in San Francisco in the early 70s,
and I was trying to get a teaching job and get in graduate school and do some stuff. And I lived there and met somebody who lived there who I was into Crotalitz big time. I had, such a big part of my life. And met a guy outside of San Francisco who was into Crotalitz and had Catalanensis, rattlesnake, and a lot of things that I just blew my mind, you know, looking at Clauber's big books. The only picture you ever saw was one in there.
Yeah.
And, this guy, was a big cocaine dealer and, rode with the Jokers. He was a biker. He was a tough guy. He was a good friend. Unfortunately, he died in prison, died recently. And stuff. And, he took all that money, went down to Mexico, walked in the door, and he just bought permits. He just went out and bought every permit you could because he had the money to do it, and that's how it worked. And was able to go out and do all those insular, those island forms and catch things and bring them back and stuff. But through that person, there was a big connected group of drug people that had gotten into reptiles and a few reptile shops. Where it was, pretty prevalent. And, I certainly wasn't innocent, but I never dealt stuff. And, I used stuff, but too much of a control freak, I think, to ever really get into stuff too big. For me, it was about the reptiles. I mean, sometimes we'd have shipment come in, and there'd be six guys sitting around pretty high and pretty loaded. And I was pretty sober because I wanted to pick first out of that box.
Yeah.
And it was more about the Bitus nasicornis, the rhinoceros vipers, uh-huh. or whatever was coming in. And it's always been that way. I for me, that's never left me. And for some people, it became the other thing. And then, the smuggling thing I saw early on. And I don't think I qualify as a smuggler, but early on I met Barney Tomlin and Jim Brockett of Western Zoological out there, two very important people on the West Coast. And there weren't a lot of us. I was on the East Coast and I'd fly out there because Brockett was bringing in Lepidus, Marulus, Maculosis, Willardi, things that I certainly couldn't get in the East. And so what they wanted, they would tell me, and before the Burmese python debacle, it was actually kind of a rare snake. And, I wound up a 6-foot male and put it in a hard Samsonite suitcase, put a hole in the top, put a female in the other suitcase, put a hole in the top, and shoved it on the plane. I could fly free because a previous relationship to an airline stewardess. And I'd get off the plane, walk into Western Zoo. And in fact, I just talked to Jim this weekend about it. It was really kind of funny. And he'd go, "Wow, these are great. What do you want?" And I'd take my rattlesnakes from the West Coast and pick up a few other things to help kind of pay for the trip and stuff, go back. People would meet me. We'd have a party and they'd get that stuff. And then I'd go out and look for Everglades rat snakes because Barney wanted those. And so back and forth, I don't know if I really crossed lines qualified as a smuggler. And for a guy with a long braid and a tough guy and everything, I had some kind of moral compass, I think, that has just always been there and just didn't go there. But the smuggling thing got really big, as you know, and I'm good friends with to this day with a lot of those people who made mistakes. And I will say to herpetoculture, cautiously here, that be nice, even to those people that have made a mistake, because all of your carpet pythons and all of the things that you have, especially Australian stuff, never came to this country legally.
Right.
Of that is progeny and generational line bred stuff that was brought in illegally. And that's just a fact. And everybody kind of knows that. So in some ways you can't badmouth those people and at the same time applaud your collection. So I at 75, I applaud a few guys going, "Well, I'm glad you did. But is it right? No, it's not." And I think we've,
You know, I think we're at a point where, you know, I would hope that almost everything is being produced, so you don't see the smuggling you used to have. If I can go buy something for $1,000, why would I take the chance going to prison, you know, right, and smuggle something in? It doesn't make much sense today. And so there is that, you know. Yeah, it was, boy, what a crazy, crazy time. You know, you walk in the shop and you go, where'd you get that? You know?
Yeah.
And of course, and a lot of people paid the price for that, as they should have, you know. It's just, you know, you take that chance, you get kind of selfish, and, you know, so I would encourage people out there to do the right thing. You can still grow the braid and look cool, and you don't have to be a smuggler, and you can go buy that $10,000 python from Roy. I mean, he looks like he's well set up back there. So I'm just saying, I don't know, you know. So
not a single python here, unfortunately. But
well, I went through boars and pythons, and I'm not a smart guy, and I don't know the attraction to me late in life. I will say, though, that I don't know of anybody who's kept more in 60 years, more species of snakes than I have, except maybe Tommy Crutchfield. Yeah. But I've been through a lot of stuff, and I gave up the rattlesnake thing when I moved back to Florida because of grandkids, and I had several bites, which is, by the way, always your fault if you're bit. And probably couldn't handle another one. So it was time. And look, I'm back into colubrids and an eclectic mix. Some things you couldn't sell for $5, but it's stuff I love.
Oh,
so,
yeah.
So, you know, so the passion's there. And
absolutely.
That's my word. If you're not passionate, and you don't have that feeling, and you don't look at a steak when you're 75 and go, ah, Linda, I need a pair of those. And I go, well, no, I don't. You know? No, I don't. I don't need anything. But, you know, so there you go. Yeah, just kind of around the corner kind of thing about the whole subject. But, yeah, there was a lot of smuggling, a lot of illegal activity, a lot of drugs. But I'm not so sure that's just unique to herpetoculture and herpetology. You know, there's a lot of, there's sports and there's sports people and there's, you know, it's, we're just artifacts. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
But, you know, we get the attention because you have the purple hair and you have a snake. So, you know, it's all drugs, exactly. Purple hair and snakes, you know?
Well, along those same lines, I think it's pretty common for, you know, something that I see all the time, and it's not that I think there's anything wrong with this, but it can get kind of tired sometimes, is, you know, you'll see someone post, for example, on some social media platform, they'll post a price list from like 1985 or something.
I have them all to go back to the 60s.
By all means, it's very cool, right? Because it shows kind of like an interesting sliver of the past. It's a wonderful piece of history. It's great. But I sometimes worry that, or not even worry, but I wonder if, you know, people kind of romanticize the way things were 50, 60, 70 years ago. And I'm wondering if you feel that way. Like, you know, do you look back on the sort of,
the good old days?
Yeah. The good old days as the good old days. So do you feel like we've made any kind of good trade-offs in the way that there's more, like maybe a little bit more regulation around some of this stuff? Do you think it should be more open? How do you feel about all that stuff?
Oh, you know, absolutely. I mean, I cherish those days. I spent the weekend with a lot of old guys in California. You know, Tom Moisey, his 80th birthday celebration, who I'm dedicating the Pitchu Opus book to. And you know, a lot of people, and we brought out a bunch of, Jim Brockett was there, he's 81, and we brought out a lot of old Western Zoo lists, and to see the things on that list, you will never see them again. They will never be available to you again, unless somehow you can get them illegally. Crazy stuff. There was a tuatara on one list. I mean, imagine that. So, you know, so yeah, I mean, there was that. It was exciting times. I you know, golly, going down shops to Louis in Joe Beriducci down to the shed, and they'd have, you know, have a shipment coming in, and away we'd kind of party, and you know, God, there was so much coming in so fast, so much to learn, so much you didn't learn, you know, and easier to go places and collect things. So, but fast forward, there is a trade-off there, and I think the good part there is that we went from when I started, nobody knew how to breed snakes. That was the big thing. You know, we just didn't know. And the few zoos that were breeding them were reluctant to share knowledge, you know, with yet to be called herpetoculturists. Tom Huff coined that years ago. And so, you know, it was, you know, so primitive. But fast forward today, you have so many people who have unraveled some very difficult species. I mean, including bolens and things that were just, you know, Airy, thank goodness, went there and figured out some of it. Still a tough snake to breed. But you know, there's so much out there. And look, there's so many old guys in arms here, old mentors and things, would be applauding it, the success that people have had. And look, and you know, you can argue the captivity thing to extremes. I mean, I can give you lots of examples and can counteract a lot of that. I have no problem with the snake in the box as long as you take care of that snake and that snake is kept clean and fed properly and have those things. And we've refined things to a point where I think things are better. I mean, there's always those few that, but you'll have that in anything that don't do the right things. But look, we have a lot available to us. So look at the information. And we'll talk about this a little later. But look at the morph thing. And you know, of course, you get people that trash morph people and trash, you know, the other side of the coin. Locality specific people, but look at people like Gregor Mendel, the founder of genetics. He would be applauding this. He'd go, "Oh my gosh, my little Punnett square has now got, you know, 128 boxes and you know, we golly, done some really interesting, cool things." We've done a few things that aren't so cool, but for the most part, I'm not stuck in the past. It was a good time, but look, the present's pretty cool too. You know, yeah. I go and see some of your guys' collections. I walk in, I go, "Wow." You know, you would never see that 60 years ago. So, as far as regulations and things, that's very difficult. And for me, that's just because law enforcement and people and legislation and finances, we don't do a good job educating. We don't do a good job explaining what we're doing. I get inspected. I have fish and game people come in here and, you know, they come in, they come in and turn their GoPro camera on saying they've been recorded. And I tell them at the same time, as you, and you're being recorded. And of course, they take a step back and think, really, you know. But in 30 minutes, we're good friends. We had a commonality about they like how clean and I have a snake room that where I carve wood and build things and I have some nice cages and they like all of that and we start talking and I do things for fish and game and those people are there some bad people? Sure, you know, it's like anything. I mean, when you take a nail gun and you start nailing pythons to a piece of plywood, what happened here is outrageous. I mean, if you did that with somebody who had 50 cats and the health department shut them down and you did it to a cat, the world would come unglued. But, you know, so there is that. We have a long way to go. But you know, the continued dissension and animosity, and when we fuel that, you know, out there, it doesn't help anybody. You know, you need to work together and hopefully we're allowed to continue to do the things we love. You know, I always ask a fish and game guy when they come, I go, "What's your passion?" And if he says bass fishing or something, I go, "How would you feel if they took all that away?" And he'll say, "Well, that's ridiculous." And I said, "Well, it's ridiculous if you're a bass fisher.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous if I'm a snake guy. You're taking away my passion. Right. And I've look, I've never been arrested for anything. And I, you know, I'm, and I'll tell you, flat out, I mean, you're not going to take my passion away from me because I'm not doing anything wrong. You take my, collection away tomorrow. I have enough friends. I will have another collection the next day. And it'll be right here because I think it's 75. I know what's right and what's wrong. And we're not really doing anything wrong. We could do better. And some people certainly could do better and probably don't belong, you know, shouldn't have any animals. And that's a whole different discussion. We can debate that. And then I have a lot to say about all of that. And, look, if your neighbor complains about you having snakes in a box or lizards in a box and they have a horse and they ride the horse, I'm sure if you asked the horse, they wanted a 250 pounder, you know, sitting on their back, they would probably say no. So that's an extreme example, but we can go all over the place with pets and animals. We're a society of pets. We're a society, and we goes back, you know, thousands of years. We've always kept animals, and we always will. Mm-hmm. So when done correctly, I don't have a problem with any of that or see that. And I think we've come a long way. So kind of a long-winded answer to your question, but I look back and I go, like this weekend in California, reflecting about stories, man, you know, what an exciting time and you know, so much stuff. And yet I that passion bubbles over with me today. I still see stuff that's so cool and new people and doing things. And I hope we can continue to do what we do. And we always will, by the way. I told Fishing Game, I said, if you make this so unreasonable, you know what's going to happen. I mean, you have permits. You know where everybody is who has collections. If you make it so tough and you do some of the things you've done, people just are going to stop buying permits. Now you don't know where they are.
Yeah,
and now you need a warrant to come in their house. And it gets more complicated for you guys as well. So, let's try to hit a balance here and do the right thing. And it's really about education too. A lot of fish and game people don't like snakes. They're like everybody else and don't understand it. But if you've got somebody at your house, take 10 minutes, make a friend. In fact, two officers over here, my son's cabin in law enforcement, his department pays more than fish and game. And he's hired two agents that have come into my house to inspect me after talking to them. And I ask about their families and they go, yeah, you know, kind of a struggle. And I go, yeah, I don't pay you guys too well to start. And they go, no, they don't. And I go, well, my son's hiring. Uh-huh. That's true. He's hired two of them. So I love it.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's great.
Fish and game. That's one way to do it. For that. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, totally. Yeah. Well, Craig, I'm curious. I mean, you spoke earlier a little bit about like your love for crotalids, and you also spoke about just, you know, the broad breadth of species that you've kept up to this point. And
sure.
I'm curious if you could speak a little bit to your passion for crotalids, specifically why crotalids, and then also, you know, in this era of your keeping post crotalids. Are there any species that really stand out to you as just that just really have a special place in your heart? I'm curious to hear.
Well, you know, here again, I'm so passionate about so much stuff. Yeah. Well, of course, you know, crotalid rattlesnakes were big, and I went up and met Caulfield, you know, before he died.
Wow.
Back collected with a few of his own personal notes, and you know, I hungry and. I think matching pattern and scale and rattle and an animal that develops a protein as a food getting device that is so overdeveloped it can eliminate an elephant, which is, you know, very rare in the animal kingdom to have something that so developed that it can do something like that. Not necessarily a rattlesnake, but certainly some cobras. That whole package really fascinated me, interested me. And the scientific part of the whole thing, the medical part of it as well, and then and the snakes. So I was just, gosh, all in. And there's not a day goes by. I mean, I have so many friends now. And I think when you get get old, they're afraid you're going to die. So they offer you all kinds of really cool stuff. And I always say, where were you 30 years ago when I wanted this Obscurus, or I wanted, the Salvinia with stuff you couldn't get? Here, you can have a cup, a pair of them. And, you know, I go, you know, wow, look. And then I go, well, of course, you know, at this point, I'm not going back. I made that commitment to myself. But Venomous for me is certainly something that all of that stuff is just remarkable to me. And, you know, I have old fashioned glass front cages, and I do have a few racks, nothing wrong with those, but I observe so many snakes and so many things. And, I'll give an example. I had cantails. I had Balinese telleri, some of the first ones in the country. And, of course, cantails, as well as a lot of Kistanon, babies caudal. They have a little yellow-green tip tail, and they caudal and to attract prey and stuff. Right. But at the time, nobody had ever observed adults' cantails doing that. And we had big glass front cages and having them for years, and walked in, I go, man, they're coddling. They're doing the same thing as juveniles do. So, you know, things like that. I mean, herpetoculture, when you have things around for a long time and you're observing and looking at things, it can tell you a lot of things. And so I appreciated that about the venomous and that sort of thing, but got into boas and pythons. And, you know, Dave and Trace and I did a lot of things together for a while. And, golly, you know, so many stories there, bringing some of the first stuff, and but never abandoned colubrids, you know. Look, I have corn snakes here. I have things that, I can't just, other than saying I'm a rattlesnake guy, I am, but golly, Here's how far all over the place I am. A few years ago, I always walk around show, and young guys hate to see me coming because I'm going to start talking to them. You know, I was asking, hey, how you doing? You know, ball pythons, you know, Bob's balls. You know, I'm going, hey, you might want to change the name. I don't know. It's just, you know, I don't know. Is that working for you? And if he's listening, it actually does. He's very successful, very good guy, great collection and stuff. And, you know, people are trashing ball python people, just a ball python show, et cetera. I don't see that. I kept ball pythons when they were called royal pythons, and they would come in at over five feet long. When's the last time you saw a 5-foot ball python? You won't see one under the show, which is a whole interesting dynamic, by the way. These giant royal pythons full of ticks and parasites and things, and, you know, and would come in. But, you know, I walk around and I stop and look at everything. I look at ball pythons and I go, how in the world do you get shark repellent orange? You know, it's the cap. It's the cap. And you go to Home Depot and you look at the spray paints, and there's that one cap that's so obnoxious. You wish you hadn't seen it. And you look down at a pair of snakes today and you go, how in the world is that a reptile color? I mean, I'm mesmerized by that. You know, I think that's just, you know, really cool. So, you know, I like it all. I like every bit of it. I can't keep all of it. But a few years ago, the point I was trying to make, I went in and there was a graduate student. He's sitting at a little table. It wasn't decorated or anything. And he had a bunch of cups on it. And they were all, I still call them keeled green snakes. They're rough green snakes to be proper today, but they were green snakes. And I looked down, I go, that's all you got here, right? And he goes, yep, three generations of them. And I said, you know, this is the coolest stuff in the whole show. who's here with green snakes? You know, and I kept green snakes for a long time. I caught one in Gainesville. It was 4 feet that actually ate a nose. Wow. So you can add that to caterpillars and everything else they eat.
Yeah.
But so, you know, that's, to me, that's the stuff, out of the box stuff, you know. And I think you're starting to see a little bit more of that. You know, I say there's so many underappreciated species, you know, the commonality of everybody wanting the same thing and what's hot and what's not. You know, I mean, for 1 year, you know, hognose snakes, you know, get big, and for 2-3 years, man, it's like crazy. Black kings, you know, and then everybody produces them, and then you don't see them again. So it's kind of an up and down thing. I've never been that way. I only keep the things that I really love and passionate about, and I breed them and give away most of my stuff, and I do sell some stuff once a year when I go to the show, which is fine. You know, treat your family to a little vacation, and whoever's in your life deserves that. Trust me.
Yeah. Well said. Well said.
Interesting.
Well, Craig, I'm curious about, like, I mean, obviously you've been keeping for a long time, and I'm curious if your kind of personal philosophy has changed over that span of time, or if it's remained somewhat consistent, or what parts have, you know, remained consistent, what parts might have changed.
Philosophy as related to?
The keeping, you know, keeping animals, like your method, your style, so to speak, of keeping.
Because this Pitchovis book is I'm writing for Eco Publishing, is the complete Pitchovis. I don't like that term, and Bob knows that. Mm-hmm. It's not complete. It's not a Andrew Holy Cross Trieste 500 pages on Pyromlana, which is an incredible book. This is not that, mm-hmm. But to complete that series, you know, I address everything, and I go into old caging and what we have today. And of course, the industry is just, it's amazing what they've come up with. But I'm really old school. I'm if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And I do the same things I've done for 50 years, you know, successfully. I do not have a problem keeping animals when they're done right. I'm pretty strict. I'm pretty outspoken. And people don't keep stuff right, you know. Mm-hmm. Don't let me come walking in and see dirty cages and shit all over the place. And you know, I don't like that. I'm borderline OCD. I call it OCB, mm-hmm. obsessive compulsive blessing. More people should have it, you know. I'm kind of a neat freak, and you know, I don't like that. So, I mean, my philosophy is, if you're going to do it, look, more isn't better. And what you see today is that, you know, I think it's funny, speaking to what you just asked. If I don't know somebody and somebody will say, "Hey, look, I'd love to stop by and see your facility someday," that word facility. And I go, wow, well, I don't have a facility. I now have one room. It's actually a big bedroom that's converted. And I have overtaken my wife's big walk-in closet. We have a nice big house, and it's nicely appointed. And I did take over her walk-in closet for my neonate rack, you know, so to speak. Things are different today because, you know, people have Linda just stuck her head around the corner. She heard that. I'm telling the world that, you know, yeah, sorry about that. I just lost my point there with Linda sticking her head around the corner.
No, that's okay. Yeah. You were just speaking to just, you know, these days people having, you know, larger collections.
Well, more is not better. And I think that there's a problem. And you certainly didn't see that early on. We didn't have, you know, massive, huge collections because number one, you couldn't afford to feed them. I still breed my own rodents. I have 55 years and you had to back then and do that. But now, you know, you see people with thousands of snakes and racks and, you know, I don't know if they're taken care of. I guess it's okay. I kind of have a problem if I have to slide something open and I only see it once a week. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of, to me, it's kind of like, what's the point? I mean, I kind of want to see the animal, interact with the animal. I want to see what's going on with the animal, what they're doing, appreciate the color and form and pattern and scale and all of that. So, you know, I mean, I have my preferences. I don't know if it's right or wrong, but you see a lot of that. You see a lot of huge collections today that I wonder, you know, if it's just strictly driven by the dollar, you know, I mean, good luck, you know, that's a tough go. And I hate to see that because the passion for snakes those animals themselves just really isn't there. It's driven by something else. So,
right.
You know, so, yeah, I don't know if I answered your question, but.
Oh, you did. You did. You did well. Yeah. I'm curious also if just, you know, I mean, you've clearly spent a lot of time in the field. I know you've collected many of the rattlesnakes that you kept in the past, mm-hmm. and all that. And so you have an intimate understanding of their habits, you know, in situ and in the field where they belong. And I'm curious if there's anything that you've taken from that has really influenced the way you keep. I mean, I imagine there must be.
Great question. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. You know, when we're learning to try to breed things, I'll give you an example. I want to say the largest Lepidus collection, rock rattlesnake collection, 40 years ago at the time, I had Rulus and Maculosus and Aguas Calientes, Lepidus, a lot of rare Lepidus, but I couldn't breed them. Nobody was really breeding them. And so, you know, why is this? And, you know, we didn't know. So, you know, when you go out collecting, you start observing animals and, you know, what they're doing, where they're living, you know, what are the temperatures, you know, are they fall breeders, spring breeders? You're trying to figure all this out. And in captivity, I flew out to Conroe, Texas, and there was a guy out there that was breeding Willardine Lepidus before anybody. And his name was Kelvin Scott. And I flew out there and walked in this kind of shed, and he had 10-gallon metaframe aquarium, so the slate bottoms, the chrome.
He had
a Willardine Lepidus in each one. He had a handful of pine needles. And he had a rock and a water dish, and he fed them 5-6 times a year, a big Scolopris.
Yeah.
And you know, and he had a light. It was very hot at one end, very hot. And I went, wow, that's all you do? It just seems kind of foreign, but couldn't argue with him, right? Because he was breeding everything.
Yeah.
And I got to know, I was breeding Vic Grandes that I'd gotten from Hugh Kuhn from the Houston Zoo before anybody had him in captivity. And I was trading him for the stuff I wanted for the Vic Grandes. But so by observing that, so I went back and started doing cloacal temperatures of Lepidus. I mean, golly, I started tearing rock up underneath an incandescent bulb to see where they would go. And these guys were getting right up underneath that bulb, cloacal temperatures of 102, 104. And, you know, it was like, wow. Well, guess what? They started breeding, you know. So,
amazing.
You know, through that observation and doing that and observation in the wild, and certainly things like Eastern Diamondbacks that nobody was breeding, I started breeding them and stuff by just paying attention to what they're doing when they're out. That's where the, you know, when you're in the field a lot, you really start to, you know, put two and two together. And to that note, I made a note to myself, don't ever confuse a snake in a box, a captive snake, with a wild snake, because you cannot duplicate those. I mean, if we could do it perfectly, obviously Boland's pythons would be bred every year. They're still very, very difficult. And even though Aries supplies so much information and knowledge, even Aries has a difficult time with them. We don't know all those parameters and things to plug in. And I tell people, you know, what you have in that box and you've raised is not the same as what's out there. You may traditionally have fall breeders in the wild that spring breed. I have a pair of very rare Lineatocolus gibsoni, Guatemalan.
Amazing snakes.
Gorgor snakes. And yeah, they really are. You know, they're traditionally fall breeders, but not necessarily in captivity. So, you know, things are very different. And you have to know the snake, but you also have to, you can't pretend they're in the wild because they just aren't. Create the exact same environment and stuff for them, which is okay. I think being in the field and looking for things just tells you so much about the animals.
Agreed. Yeah, it's been such a such a game changer for me, spending more and more time in the field. And the more time I spend in the field, the more I want to spend time in the field.
Yeah. Well, the problem there is that, how old are you? You're in your
30s? I'm 33. Yeah, I'm 33.
Well, you say you're 33. You're missing the opportunity because you're about to get really busy. Uh-huh. Between 33 and 55, you'll be at the most busiest part of your life, work, family, interests. You get to middle age and all of a sudden a few health concerns can creep in there, certain problems. It's part of aging. You're not really old. You're at a point where you're hopefully, making enough money that you have to start thinking very hard to do today. To save and what's the future? You think completely different. Very hard to find that time to get in the field. So when you do, and of course, then sometimes you leave family and other things and interests and kind of feel bad about that. But when you get an opportunity to go, and especially with somebody who kind of knows their way around, some of my great friends are really not educated people. A few of them are backwoods people that, oh my gosh, they know so much. They know so much. And I've learned so much from those people. And at the same time, I think some of those commercial collectors that I used to hang out with, not by shaming them, but by teaching them things, they've changed a lot of their ways and stuff. So, in the field look. Look, when you find a target animal or use something, it's just you'll never forget those feelings,
Oh, it's so true.
Yeah.
It's
the best. You can buy something and be really excited about it, but it's not the same, flipping that rock or looking in there and go, gosh, there it is. 3 years of looking, here it is.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, true that.
Phil, I want to let you get in there a little bit. I've been dominating the question. So
So one thing I'm kind of curious about is, you've been involved in this game for so long, Craig, and you've been, deeply embedded in every facet of what we do, and your passion is so clear. Like, what are the things that right now that excite you the most about herpetoculture and herpetology, sort of broadly,
Oh, well, I'm writing about this in my book, which is driving me nuts. The taxonomy today, don't get me started. I'm ready to go hunting a few PhDs, which I am not. Look, I understand DNA and studies and everything and the new phylogenetics, but what a mess. What a mess. We've got zoogeographers, we have morphologist, and we have DNA people, and it's really a balance of all that kind of stuff. And they don't have things right. Certainly don't have Pituophis right. It's all over. And any path I choose to assign nomenclature to, half of you are going to hate it and half of you are going to like it. So, I think Dr. Hillis or somebody once said, hey, it's your book, own it. Have some kahunas and go out there and do it. Nobody else is doing it. So I've chosen some paths. But I think the exciting part there is that, and look, DNA, certainly, I've learned that, you can't argue with DNA and evidence. I mean, it is what it is. It's a science and it doesn't lie. But when you involve selected criteria to prove certain points and you expand that where it shouldn't be, it gets very complicated, and complicated for me as well. And I don't think we have things right yet, but I think we're getting there. So I think science and a lot of this will help spell out some things and let us know ancestry and how things evolved and where things came from. And I think that's extremely exciting. I mean, I went to the Galapagos and God, what an exciting place, what a great place. Cause it's just, there's so much there involving evolution and genetics and things. But from that standpoint, I think it's very exciting today. I love the genetics. People look at me and shake their head when I say I like morphs. Hopefully we're not letting them go and we're not hybridizing stuff. We're just fast forwarding genes. So, Gregor Mendel and Bernd Bechtel, the modern day Gregor Mendel, would applaud all this, saying, oh my gosh, it's so interesting. And it is interesting. you know, so I'm always kind of interested to see that. Doesn't mean I particularly want those things, but I think it's very interesting to see how that plays out. And off the subject, I'll just work this in here because it's something I always like to speak to. So in herpetoculture, we have two groups of people. And I want people to concentrate on this. I want everyone to get over themselves because we need to be friends with one another. And there's some animosity. And I don't like this. I hate ball python people. I hate this. I hate that. You know, need to get over that. So if you're a strict locality guy, I'm going to ask you a question. You know, are you really breeding strict locality stuff? So when you produce something, all of us, we hold back our best animals sometimes, right? We produce something, a clutch, and I got to keep this one back. Well, we keep the 10 back. We don't keep the 5 back. If you're truly breeding locality-specific snakes, you're holding a 5 back because that's representative of the average snake that's true locality. And when you line breed, and I hunted Okeetee from the start, when you line breed Okeetee corn snakes like we have over the years and say they're strict locality, well, yeah, I mean, kind of, but you'll never see a snake like that in the wild.
Right.
So, exactly. So those people have to settle that a little bit, and you know, and the more people too, and I'd like to see those people kind of get along because they bring something to the table that's interesting for everybody, and you know, in captive herpetoculture, those snakes are just, they're not really going anywhere. We're not creating those genes, by the way. We're just fast forwarding them. I mean, the chances of getting together in the wild, it can happen and does sometimes, but it's rare. But, you know, I don't have enough life. I want to see everything that's happening and what's going on, how that happens.
Sure.
So, I think it's still exciting. I think eventually, you know, the economics of all of this stuff, the people that aren't truly passionate will fall by the wayside. We all know people who get in, they throw everything in and then they're out in 5 years or 10 years, everything out.
They're
just all in and they're all out. If you're really passionate, you're never out. And I think we are. I think we are. And, I had to work that little thing in there because I see people going, gosh, you know, that's shit in that cup. And I go, well, explain that to me, you know, because, you know, I won't say the guy's name. He's a good friend. I go, well, Bob, you're a strict locality guy. Let me ask you a question. Do you hold tens back or fives? Well, you hold tens because I do. Nobody looks in that clutch and goes, yeah, well, that's really the good one there, but I'll take the average. We don't do it, you know. And so you never confuse a snake in the wild with a snake in a box. It's what we do.
Right.
You know? Yeah.
Well said.
I mean, I agree with you wholeheartedly. I have a profound appreciation for every facet of what we do. Every sort of angle of herpetoculture and herpetology is really, really interesting to me.
Well, good, because you're passionate about this stuff.
Yeah.
And
right.
I don't know where that comes from. You know, cause you talk to somebody, you see hollow looks on their face. And I don't know if I've ever had that. If I'm sitting around anywhere with snake people, snakes, I can't shut up. It's exciting stuff.
Yeah, it's really cool.
Right. Yeah.
Well, and even like you just mentioned the locality thing, there's other things about locality stuff too. It's like, well, okay, like at what point is something, you know, okay. So for like, let's say hognose, right? Like Western hognose snakes, right?
Yep.
I live in Colorado.
Okay.
Someone could say, all right, oh, well, you know, I have hognose that come from Roggen, Colorado. It's like, okay. So you're going to tell me that a Roggen locality hognose ends at the city limit? What? Like, okay, so you're going to draw the line over the railroad track, but as soon as I go 5 feet on the other side, it's not a Roggen locality hog anymore.
Like, yeah, where you get a lot of that.
That's
a whole new subject. It's very interesting to me.
Yes.
And now, the nomenclature, what we name and call things.
Yeah.
Right.
Island stuff, right? So now if we're talking about island stuff, now things get really cool because it's like, I know that chuckwalla comes from San Esteban Island because
San Esteban chucks. Absolutely.
It's awesome. It's great.
Orange, black speckly cool looking things. Yeah.
Yeah. Super cool. Super cool. And because now it's like the natural world is drawing the border for me in a way that, you know, it doesn't involve my, well, over the railroad track, it's not Roggen anymore. It's like, well, it ends at the ocean because Chuck stopped there, you know, right. Mm-hmm. And, but I also feel that way. I am also interested in hybrids as well. So I know you mentioned hybridization earlier, and I don't think everything needs to be, right?
Hold on. You know, natural hybridization is really interesting to me. Oh, because it does happen.
Yeah. Totally.
And look, some people have done things in captivity and stuff. It's okay. The problem is if you're just doing that, but if it makes it to a table in a show,
right,
and degradizes something else and is not what it is, I have kind of problems with that. It's like exophthalma in Texas rat snakes, and you see it in some corn snakes. Large eye, and exophthalma, is an inheritable condition. And, you know, mm-hmm. instead of putting that animal in a freezer, you see a cute bug-eyed snake, you know, per se. So, mm-hmm. you know, sort of thing. So,
sure.
Yeah.
For sure. I mean, I feel like everything, whether it's, you know, generating special mutations, whether it's hybridization, whether you're dealing with something venomous, whether you're dealing with something large, it all has to be done with a level of responsibility, you know, and we sort of engaging with it requires that we trust that there are going to be other people who steward that work into the future. Right. Because,
you really hit a good point here, and you talk a long time about it, but you know, unfortunately, economics and people, you know, trying to sell stuff, make a buck, there's a lot of dishonesty in the industry and stuff, you know, and I look at certain things, but, you know, all of that stuff is really of interest to me. So I'm not, you know.
Yeah. I think it's really cool to talk about, right? I think this is this particular part of the conversation, I feel like has piqued my interest a lot. Not because I love the whole conversation so far, but this one for me is like a very, I find this one to be highly interesting. So let's take, you know, one of the primary species that I probably do most of my work with is Uromastix ornata. That's the thing that it just happens to be, those are the things that I breed the most.
Sure.
And I've worked with them a very long time. I love Uromastix ornata. Well, Uromastix ornata have a massive range, right? As you know, they get all over Israel, Egypt, Jordan, you know, the huge range.
Sure.
And the concept of having locality specific Uromastix ornata for me is impossible, right? There is no way for me to verify that this group of animals came from the same half mile pile of rocks in Jordan, right? It's just not possible, right?
Well, maybe in your lifetime, we'll have a DNA scratch test.
That would be great, right? That would be super cool. But at least at the moment.
But we don't have it today.
Right. Like at least at the moment we don't have that. Right.
That's correct.
So, as fun as it might be, and as entertained as I would be in being able to produce, say, Jerusalem specific locality or not, Uromastix or not, that'd be awesome. It'd be so cool, but you know, I can't, but then we can, let's kick that a little bit further. It's like, okay, if I'm going to preserve ornata in captivity for as long as I can, I'm going to be crossing animals, presumably that were collected in Egypt, with animals that were collected in Jordan or in Israel, right?
Well, this just isn't a lizard thing.
Yeah, no.
We all do this,
right?
And we don't truly define it as hybridization. I should say my thought on hybridization is crossing, you know, species, not substitutes. You're crossing species. You know, a Campbell eye with a corn snake, sort of thing.
Sure.
Interesting. But what you're talking about, in order to keep healthy populations, do all those things. And look, science does it all the time. Some of the cycads, they're down to like one female, and they to save it, they've hybridized it or something. Yeah, we do that. And they're captive snakes. I mean, we all do it. I mean, I have stuff.
Oh, yeah.
talking to the level you are, I mean, I can go through any collection and say, well, no, this isn't strict locality.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, all the carpet pythons that came in, you know, when they came in, I know the five people that brought them all in, and they really, it's become a homogenous blend.
Yeah.
Of a jungle carpet python or something. Yeah. You're absolutely right. I don't have a problem with that, because it's kind of natural evolution of keeping things over time in captivity, and you're breeding new things. Until we have that scratch test, how do you verify every new animal coming in? I mean, when you know a lot about an animal, you look at it, you say, yeah, this looks like the real deal sort of thing. But, you know, how do you really know? I don't know.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's other considerations to be made too, that, you know, might maybe push the boundaries of whether it's like, okay, you know, I can make the choice to maintain these animals for a long time in captivity, and therefore I'm going to be making a cross between two animals that, despite being the same species, their genetics haven't interacted in millennia, right? And, sure. And it's cool to be, I think at a certain point we're making a decision about how to best serve the future animals in our care, right? Because if I were to restrict myself to something being locality specific, and again, I'm all for locality specific animals. It's not a criticism at all, but it is true though, that if I was going to restrict myself and say, well, I'm going to assume that this first shipment of Uromastix ornata that I ever purchased from, they came from Jordan. And I'm just going to treat them all as a single locality. And I'm only going to breed those animals to other animals that came in that single shipment. This could conceivably be, depending on the number of animals that I had, this could conceivably be a, like down the road long enough could be a detriment to them, when it would be in their best service long-term, especially if they're going to be animals that are merely going to be traded in the pet trade, you know, just propagated for our enjoyment. It would make sense for me to breed them in such a way that allows them to live the best lives they can as healthy, thriving animals. Therefore, you know, genetic diversity.
Well, sure. And if you take those same animals and you fast forward 20 years and say, I'm just doing these Jordan animals, and you kind of accepted blind faith, you weren't there and collected them yourselves, but I'm just breeding these Jordan animals. It goes back to my point. In 20 years, are you really? Aren't you keeping the best breeders?
Yeah. Right.
You know, if you have a Santa Esteban Chuck, and you know, you've got one that's 60% orange and pepper, you go, man, that one's staying with me. Well, right. Fast forward 20 years, you're actually breeding snakes or lizards you'd never find in Santa Esteban.
Yes.
I mean, oh, you might, right. But
yeah.
So, you know, it's very difficult in captivity. And my point is just get over ourselves. Just be honest with what you're doing.
Well,
just saying, hey, look, totally here we are. But you're going to run into a conflict because people, you know, the purists, you know, claim to be this and that. And I challenge that. If you have snakes in a box and keep them in captivity or lizards or whatever, you're kind of really are.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
and right. we can debate the lines you're talking about and lines I'm talking about all day long.
Yeah.
And actually prove that. So, you know,
right.
So yeah, I don't have a problem with that at all.
Yeah. And I love that analogy. I love like the five or the 10.
I struggled for years to try to get my point across, and finally it just hit me. I said to Brian, this guy, I go, okay, Brian, look, you're breeding the most incredible. I won't give too much away here, but the most, you know, I believe me, I lived out there. They're just incredible looking, but it's better than anything from that exact area,
right?
Even though, because it's selected breeding, and you cannot not do it. You are not going to take that 80% orange speckled Santa Esteban Chuck and put it on the table. If you can, I will look you straight in the eye and I would say, well, I don't want to offend you, but you're probably fudging or lying a little bit.
Right. Well, I love this because the way I've described this, and I apologize to our listeners on the show because I'm sure I've said this like 150,000 times by now, but the way I've always thought about this is we as keepers are imperfect selectors. So you might have a situation where, let's take the Ornata example again, right? Let's say you have a clutch of Euromastix Ornata that it's there's 10 eggs, and 9 of them hatch on Monday and get eaten by a bird of prey that happened to be sitting right there near the nest. And then on Tuesday, that 10th one hatches and it's a little runty, it's a little thin, it's a little small, but the bird's gone or it's full and it decides not to eat it. And that's the thing that moves on and passes on its genetics and lives.
Well, and this is what's fascinating. This is what happens in the world today. Yeah,
right.
And you see this happening all the time. It's happening in everybody. It's a Burmese python. The Burmese python, when the population exploded, were feeding on raccoons. People worried about, raccoons disappearing. Well, on the other side of that coin is they ate a lot of raccoons. But this year is the first year that the subspecies of diamondback terrapin down there, they found hatched eggs that raccoons haven't eaten, because raccoons are just killing their nesting sites. And interesting enough, the Burmese python now, one of their primary prey items are alligators, and they're eating, 4 and 5 foot alligators, and then 8 foot alligators are eating Burmese pythons. So, it's a stretch from what you're saying, but yeah, I mean, things are in constant flux and constant moving and constant changing, Right. So it'd be interesting to go back and look at Euromastix 1,000 years ago, conservators, and say, wow, these are kind of different. I mean, that's kind of a quick, it's not very much time in evolution, but I'm just saying it'd be interesting to see. As if you've looked at something 30 or 40 years, you see those subtle differences and stuff. I'm going to that in Pituopus. I mean, they want to put Ruth and I, Louisiana pine snake, over, take it out of the pine snake chain and put it in the gopher snake chain and the catenifer chain and make it a gopher snake. Based on Robles and a few people's DNA. I it's subjective, but and I have some other thoughts that are not subjective. But if I've looked at those snakes for 50 or 60 years, and all of a sudden you try to make a swan out of a duck, I'm not going along with it, because I can just visually looking at something. And look, science says that's subjective, but I don't write that off. If somebody has looked at a Euromastix their whole life, you will see things that some taxonomists will never see.
Right.
And don't abandon that. That's important stuff to listen to.
Yeah, so, value.
Yeah, absolutely.
Fascinating.
Hey, look, I may, if I unplug my earphones, are we going to get into this little thing again and plug in?
I think you'll be okay.
I'm going to need... Will I be able to hear you? I think
you should.
I think so. Yeah.
Are you talking?
Yeah. Here we are. Can you hear us?
Okay. Hold on. Are you there?
Oh yeah.
Can you hear us?
I can barely hear you though.
You got to plug in a charger.
I can't hear you very well.
Uh-oh.
Well, here you go. You're dealing with the quintessential techno dumbass. Maybe so.
You might be able to turn the volume up on the phone. That might help.
Hold on. Well,
can you hear me?
Oh, yeah. Can you hear us?
Okay. Well, I've replugged. I don't know how much power I've got left. I've got 20% or something, I guess.
Okay. Well, we don't have to go too crazy. We can
try to move towards closing. I want to be respectful of your time too. I know you're 3 hours ahead of where I am. Right?
It's what happens when you get old guys.
No, I mean, we can do this all night. This is great for us.
For sure.
But I've enjoyed every minute of this. But like I said, I know it's later for where you are. You're 3 hours ahead of me. You're in the future. So
hey. That wasn't some little undertone old guy bedtime thing, was it?
No. I wouldn't. I would never dare.
Yeah, your partner just picked up on that one. Yeah, you're just suggesting this guy's getting a little tired, right? Yeah. Well, I could probably walk you through a bunch of mountain stuff for a long time. I got 10% remaining. It just popped up.
Okay. So. Okay. 10%. Right. Okay. We got to make the most of it.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. So, did you have one, Phil? Did you want to go?
Oh, go ahead. Go. So, yeah.
Okay. Well, I guess we'll just do a couple more before we close. One I'm curious about is just, and I feel like this has maybe already been alluded to a little bit around things, but I just want to hear it maybe more succinctly from you, is just taking a broader view of herpetoculture. If you could change one thing about the current state of herpetoculture with just the snap of a finger, what would you change? What would you like to see different?
Well, look, I don't know if you can, and there's nothing wrong with it, but mm-hmm. the economic part of it, the drive to make a buck mm-hmm. out of, you know, if you're passionate, and there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, I sell snakes. I mean, I put four kids through college not doing that. I made a good income and stuff, but yeah, that helped with tuition. I don't have anything against that, but mm-hmm. I don't know if you can do that, but if we could... Mm-hmm. There was less emphasis on, you know, making that critical every nickel to the dollar sort of thing.
Yeah.
A little less and a little bit more passionate about the animals. I think it would actually work to serve you even better. You might sell something more stuff, but you know, you see mm-hmm. kind of such a focus on that and more talk on the economics is just dying. Clubids are dead. Ball pythons are this. This is that. It's the end of this. Morph market has 42,000. You know, you hear all these kind of yeah. things, and it's all driven by the economics of this. I'd rather see a little bit more about, you know, sitting around talking about how cool a Euromastic is or something else. And yeah. and I think the rest of that in the end will take care of itself. And if you look at the people who have been really successful, those are people that are really passionate, you mm-hmm. know, and it just works out. So, yeah, that's probably the thing I would, you know, would like to see change, but I don't think it will.
Yeah. Yeah. I totally hear you on that. I relate to that wish. It would be nice if the economics didn't have to be such a central factor. You know, yeah. I don't like you, I don't begrudge anyone, you know, making money from it, but I think that it's a bummer when it has to be the driving focus.
Well, yeah. And if you have four kids and they're about ready to get hungry, I mean, you know, mm-hmm. it's a business and you do that.
Yeah.
And I don't, exactly. and I'm not knocking those businesses. I'm just saying,
no,
you know, I think you can have both. I'd like to see a little bit more passion about the snakes.
Right.
Yep.
Well, what goals do you have still left on? I mean, I know you're working on a book.
Yeah, but, yeah, my goal is to get up in the morning and wake up, you know, at 75. Yeah. So, yeah. Got through a few health concerns and stuff, and I feel pretty good. So I'm finishing up this book and everything. Really, to do the same thing I've done for 60 mm-hmm. years every day. I take care of mice and rats, and I clean snake cages, and I feed snakes, and I look at them in a cage, and I don't want to change, and I'll do it till the day I die. And I love that. And that's my goal. I don't have any great goals. My goals have all come to fruition with great children and grandchildren. And I have no complaints. I feel lucky to live in this country and to have the things that I have. I work very hard for those things, but mm-hmm. I'm very grateful. My goals are to continue to enjoy this passion of mine. You know,
I love it.
I'm hoping I can find a really light gray rat snake out back there, Terry Vanavan. I gave him one when he was here, and we're by the way making. I'm a carver and I do inlaid snakes and things. He did a knife.
Yeah, your work is amazing.
And I'm doing a box, and I think we raised $8,000 on the last combination thing for good causes, and it'll be for a scholarship cause. So I got to get busy on that, but. Yeah, I'm hoping I can just pair up that gray rat snake that was hanging out near our hummingbird feeder tomorrow. those are my goals. You know, I don't have the goals. I've lived an incredible life. Not poor as a kid, not easy, but mm-hmm. man, incredible. I have no complaints. I'm married to the to hands down best woman on the planet who's put up with my shit and snake shit for 40 years. You know?
Bless her. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. You know, so
yeah.
Yeah. That's my next book. Women in Herpetoculture from both sides, those who put up with us and those who actually keep stuff, you know?
I love it. Yeah. We could use some more of those stories for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, maybe we can do a part two of this. You know, I don't know.
You'll find out
real soon when people shut down 5 minutes ago. Oh gosh, man, Trump, turn it off. You know.
Oh no way.
Do that, but
quite the opposite. I'm sure. I'm sure you that know, people will yeah, be eager to hear this.
Yeah.
And we would love to do it again.
The Pitch Office book. Hopefully, it's kind of a generous thing, but we hope October. I've about finished Fantastic. The text, and there's so many layers of writing of people don't realize. And look, and you put this kind of thing out there for a lot of criticism, and there will be, and I'm okay with all of that. You know, I'm a pretty tough guy. And for the people that are just really mean and crazy, I always ask them a question. I always say, and the title of your book is what? You know, simply meaning it's a very hard process today. Not only to get something published, but to actually do it and go through the layers of editing and everything else. So, but we're hoping to have a book, and I hope it's useful to not only the professional herpetologist, the avocational herpetologist, to the novice herpetoculturist. I hope it serves a purpose for everybody in some way. So,
I'm sure it will. I look forward to it.
A lot of pretty pictures in there. That's what sells the books. You know?
Yeah, it's important. You got to have the pretty pictures, you know.
Yeah, yeah. And you'll see a lot of old people there because when you're 75, if the book goes south and people don't like it, you only have to put up with it for 3 or 4 years. Now, if you write a book at your age and it's bad, you're going to have to listen to that for half your life. So I'm just packing with all my old friends, just pictures of my old friends. You know?
That's great.
Yeah,
that's great. Yeah.
Well, okay, Craig. So we'll go ahead and we have one more question for you. This will be our closer. Sure. We would definitely love to have you back on as many times as we can have you.
Sure. Well, it'd be my pleasure anytime.
Awesome. So our closer question, and it's one we ask everyone at the end of every show, and it's why herpetoculture? And that can be, you take that as broadly or as specifically as you like. Why do you do it? Why do we do it? Why is it important? Why does it not matter? Why does it matter? The whole thing.
Easy. Because when I started, you couldn't do it. Herpetoculture is reproducing, is breeding snakes. Mm-hmm. No, we didn't do that. Very few zoos did that. So I'm lucky. I go back to the first thing, you know, you bred. I mean, I set up my eggs in. I took newspaper and made a mulch out of it because it's like a wood product and it would produce heat. And I put 32 gray rat snake eggs in that mulch and they hatched. And so, why herpetoculture? To be honest with you, it's more than herpetology. I think they go hand in hand. Golly, you want to produce that. And starting from the beginning when nobody did that, I was talking to Lloyd Lemke on the West Coast and a lot of old guys going, hey, have you bred that? Do you know how to do that? And there's like 10 of us, 20 of us in the country. So yeah. And to see it come this far, wow, man, it's exciting. And I want to see some of that stuff that we can't breed. I want to see those problems solved. It's about the production of the two. Nothing wrong with keeping one. And I'm at the age now when somebody says, do you want a pair or something? I go, yeah, one will do. You know, probably not enough years to raise those and breed them. But I'm all in, you know. Come on, let's read that stuff and see it. Besides, baby stuff's pretty cool. You know, not always attractive, but just cool stuff. I mean, it's a quintessential word when you look at a bunch of eggs pipping, or you come in, pile of babies. You go, oh, this is so cool. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Come here and look at this. You know, oh my gosh, get the camera, you know.
Yes.
So, yeah, I want more of that.
That's awesome.
Never gets old.
Yeah, it never gets old. If you're passionate.
That's true. Yeah.
You got to take care of that stuff. So when you have two and now you have 20, you got to take care of them. Yeah.
Yeah. Well said. Well, Craig, it's been such a pleasure talking with you. We really appreciate you taking the time to join us, and we look forward to doing it again in the future. So,
well, my pleasure. Yeah. I like not all of you guys, but if it's your podcast is meaningful. Really good questions. I think you provide a really good service, and it gets the right information out there when you have people like Philip on your show and other people and stuff. I think that's important stuff, and somebody has to do that. And I think you guys have done this very well. So congratulations on that. Keep doing what you're doing.
Thank you.
We will. Much appreciated, sir.
Yep.
All right. I'm going to hit the button and close this out.
I'm grabbing a cocktail, pal. And I got
good.
And I got a pee too. So
all right.
So
perfect timing.
Okay.
Perfect timing.
All right. Love you guys. Be in touch. Hey.